This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Green from the Commercial Break Podcast. It's likely you've heard of the show if you're directly related to me or you follow our MySpace page. But I'm not here to talk to those three listeners. I'm here to appeal to people who haven't heard the show. Along with my co-host, Kristen Joy Hoadley, we're taking a deeper look at the topics that are affecting our youth today. Like, who are the people who are dating ghosts? Where did all these pickup artists come from? And why doesn't my preacher have a nicer private jet? We understand that these are the issues you really want to get to the bottom of. The Commercial Break is now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
No, it's my fault, really, for trying. 6:12, highs today of maybe record heat, highs of 85, perhaps. Windy, if you go outside right now, and I was taking a dog for a walk earlier. Man, these fuzzy things from the oak trees are being blown about. It's today's got Benadryl written all over it, if you suffer from allergies. Windy today, tomorrow, highs of 85 through Friday. Windy Saturday, same thing. Pretty much what today is like is going to be the way it is through Saturday, then a 90% chance for showers on Sunday, 70% on Monday, then a cool front comes through, knocks the high temperatures down Monday to 63, upper 60s for Tuesday and Wednesday. But before you know it, as we go further into April, the heat and humidity are going to increase. Walter Dublane joins us now, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at my alma mater, UNO, to discuss Liberation Day, as the president is calling it, the day of tariffs. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Tommy.
Let's talk good about... Thanks for taking the time with us. I think Liberation Day is a bit grandiose. It puts you in the mind of, you know, Marines marching down the street and confetti coming off of the tops of the buildings and girls running up with flowers to bankers or somebody. I don't know who they would give the flowers to. But let's start, because you and I have had this conversation 1,000 times before, maybe because today is the day the tariffs go into effect, people start paying attention. I guess we should start off, Dub, with what is a tariff and what does it mean?
A tariff is just a tax. It's a tax on goods imported into the United States. So it's kind of like our, you know, it's kind of like our sales tax, only when it's on taxes. It's on the goods that are imported into the U.S.
Do we know what Liberation Day is going to look like today, or does the White House, or have they released any details on who's going to be tariffed and how?
I don't think they've released any details. You know, he's talked a lot about, the president's talked a lot about these as being reciprocal tariffs. So, for instance, there's some countries such as India and a couple of countries in Africa and Turkey that charge fairly high tariffs on U.S. goods. And he's kind of indicated he was going to focus the highest tariffs on those people that charge tariffs on our goods. So that's why he calls them reciprocal tariffs. We currently have some of the lowest tariffs in the world. Now, the countries that usually charge the higher tariffs tend to be developing countries. So we really don't have much, for instance, with Canada and the U.S. and Europe, which is where he started. Mm-hmm. But with and so it's going to be interesting to see if that's what he does, is focus on those less developed countries, view that as a way of growing their infant industries, is the argument they get for their tariffs.
So the president says this is going to generate revenue, as it did back in the day, which, as I understand it, and I'm going to turn it over to you, Dub, because you can explain it better than I can, in the McKinley days was a revenue generator, not a, manufacturing development tool. But the president thinks that this is going to be both?
Well, I mean, obviously, any taxes that they collect will go to the U.S. government. It will be a revenue to the U.S. government. But the question is, who pays the tax? And for the most part, it's going to be U.S. citizens are now paying the taxes. Now, Trump likes to lower taxes in general. He argues about that. But these are taxes he wants to raise. And he seems to argue that they're going to be paid by the foreign countries. But there's no evidence that they might pay a little bit of it. But there's no evidence that they will pay the majority of the taxes. It'll be U.S. customers, U.S. consumers that pay the taxes.
All right, let's talk about the economics of if it costs more for you to buy a product in China, then people will start manufacturing that product here, and as a result, the U.S. economy will bring back manufacturing and it will create jobs. If that does happen, at what cost and what would that look like?
Yes, there are certainly some truth to that. But first thing to remember is, why is it being made in China in the first place? And the answer is because they can make it cheaper there. So if it gets brought back to the U.S., by definition, it'll be more expensive. So even if they're made in the U.S., the consumers will be paying more for the product, because the reason it's not made here right now is because they can make it cheaper someplace else. So again, the U.S. customers, the U.S. consumers will pay for it. Now, it will create jobs as they import some of those industries back to the U.S. The problem is that it's almost certain, as we saw it seen in the past, I mean, Canada and Mexico are already talking about doing it, is if we raise taxes, tariffs on them, then they'll file reciprocal tariffs on the products that we export to them. And so, again, it'll cost us jobs here in the U.S. in those sectors. So we'll create jobs in some areas and lose jobs in other areas. So that is not, whether it's a net gain or not is not clear.
So is there an economic number that somebody has to make per hour, a worker per hour, to be self-supporting in the United States, generally speaking? I know it depends on area to area. Cost of living is different. But generally speaking, what a laborer would have to, or a manufacturing plant would have to pay a worker per hour in order to have them not be on, be a working poor and be able to be self-sustaining and so forth?
Well, I mean, there's, you know, there are some states and cities that have used $15 an hour as kind of the, you know, raise their minimum wage up to that to try to get into an argument in that level. Now, you're still going to be pretty poor at $15 an hour, but that is a number that people have used.
So $15 an hour, 2080 is the number of hours per week, right? That's what you usually use to a year, 2080. So that comes out to $31,200. Yeah. So that's for one person working. If they have a family to support, then you would figure, well, let's double it. So that would be $62,400 if you paid them $30 an hour. If you did pay them $30 an hour and the products were manufactured here, well, how does that compare with what people that are working in the countries from whom we import products are making? They're not making $30 an hour there, are they?
Oh, no. They may not be making $30 a day. Ah. So that's part of it. There's one interesting story that says, you know, we did attack China with tariffs. And one of the things that happened because we attacked China with tariffs is that a lot of those jobs, especially those, you know, jobs for clothing and things like that, a lot of those jobs moved to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So we now have Vietnam, interestingly enough, is kind of the country where we in the fourth largest trade deficit in the world is with Vietnam. Again, it used to be with China. I mean, still China is still number one. But one of the things that's happened is a lot of those jobs that left China because of the tariffs didn't come to the U.S. They went to Vietnam and to Bangladesh and places like that. And it's not really clear that we really want those type of jobs back in the U.S. Because those are just poor, unskilled labor jobs. And that's not where we have a comparative advantage, which is what free trade is all about, is making the products where you have a comparative advantage over other people.
So let me take a break. Somebody texted in, why doesn't anyone push back on these people who say Americans will pay the tariffs as taxes? At least we get the choice to buy something that has been tariffed. You can talk, address that when we come back. Dub Lane, professor of economics and finance at UNO. Every piece of clothing I bought lately seems to be made in Vietnam or Bangladesh. Not that I'm trying to do that. It just seems like that's where they're made. And if those jobs were to come in to the United States, the sport jacket that I now buy for $199 because I'm not a member of the Rex organization, Dub, that sport jacket would manufactured here in the United States would go up to what? If I chose to pay the tariffs, or if I chose to pay the tariffs, or if I chose to, if they bring the job back here to America and they pay somebody the money that they need to live without going on federal assistance, roughly that $199 sport jacket would go up to? You got any idea?
Well, that would be $250.
Okay, so there you go. So you would pay more. You would be paying $60 more for the jacket you're paying now because of the tariff. Or you could choose not to buy it, as this person texted in. You can buy something that has, I don't know what they're trying to say. We'll address it when we come back. 621 traffic now, WWL. All right, back to Dub Lane, Walter Dub Lane, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at UNO, talking about today being the so-called Liberation Day with tariffs. I don't know that the results have been released yet. Dub, let me read a couple of texts to you, and you can jump in where you feel comfortable, all right? I own a T-shirt company. There's only three manufacturers left in the U.S. Bayside comes to mind. Their products are a little bit more expensive, but a lot of my clients like the American-made part. Tommy, this sounds like one big giant tax increase, says this text. Tax increase is disguised by telling Americans other countries are going to pay one. In fact, we are. Sounds like another joke, such as we're going to build the wall and Mexico is going to pay for it. Somebody texted in and said, I'm a mechanic and I buy any American-made tool that I can. Somebody else said, Garanimals baby and toddler clothing was once made in Louisiana, sold exclusively by Walmart. Garanimals brand clothing is now made in Vietnam. So, with all of that said, let's presume that tariffs work, that manufacturing comes back to the United States, that we pay people $30 an hour to manufacture American products and the public buys them. What does that do to inflation? What does that do to the economy? Take me through every scenario, if you can.
Well, again, certainly it's going to affect inflation. Now, the economists are, because this is a, inflation is when prices go up. Now, if this was like a one-time bump and they all of a sudden jumped up by 10% and then kind of stayed steady again, that's one thing. Whether they would go up and then keep going up is a little less certain. But some inflation is certain out of this. The other part of it was that the big bank economists have increased the probability of recession. They doubled their probability that recession will happen this year because of these tariffs. But in hearing more about that, what they're saying is the only reason they're not raising it higher is because they don't know if these tariffs will be permanent or if he's just using it to get some of the other countries to lower their tariffs and then they'll go back down again. So, if they're permanent, then their probability of recession becomes much higher. Those are the two major effects that we're predicting.
Let's talk about the economy is comprised of a lot of different things. A lot of people have money in the stock market and 401ks. At the advice of my guy, I took a lot of money out to make sure I could pay my house off. Before, as he quote him, he said, tariffs crater the economy if that happens. How is Wall Street reacting to all of this, and how is the economy in general in the United States likely to react to this?
Well, again, the Wall Street has taken a dive in the last couple of months. Right now, it's kind of flipping up and down because they're not sure exactly, again, whether these are going to be permanent or not. I predict if it becomes clear that this is a policy that's going to go and stick, then I think you're going to see a much bigger dive in the stock market. The other thing is that, yes, he's trying to create jobs in America, but again, some his first tariffs are going to be on automobiles, and yet you're hearing Detroit is not happy about this. You'd think they would be if they're the ones that are benefiting from it, that will be making cars in the U.S. More. But because automobile industry is real interesting, because right now, for instance, especially with free trade with Mexico, they may make part of it in the U.S., send it to Mexico, add something to it, bring it back to the United States, do more with it, send it to Mexico, put it together, and then import it back to the United States. So it gets really complicated. And if all of a sudden they have to pay tariff every time it crosses the border, then that whole market becomes really very bizarre.
They're going to kill me because I'm asking you a question here at 6:30, but give me a 60-second answer if you can, please, Max. And
sure.
That is, let's say the president is bluffing and playing a game of Texas Hold'em and he wins. How does the stock market react? Let's say the tariffs stay in effect and has the effect on the economy that people think it will. How does the stock market react? Either way.
If we're right, then the stock market's going to crash because if you start predicting about a recession coming up, that's going to affect very negatively on the stock market.
But if other countries cave in to President Trump's gambit, then the stock market reacts
then, and bounces back. Then we might have much more positive effects.
There you go. Thank you, Dub. Appreciate it. 6:30 time now, WWL First News. 6:44, 16 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about tariffs. Somebody texted in, and you drive a 2014 Honda CRV. Yeah, I do. I don't know what your point is in that. I live within my means, and it's a dependable vehicle, and it's got a timing chain, not a belt, and I'm going to drive it till it dies because I just live a conservative lifestyle. But because of that, I don't really have to worry about tariffs because I don't spend that much money at all, and whatever effect it's going to have is going to be minimal on me. I worry about people that are living either above their means or are overextended and are going to be hurt by this because they're not going to be able to pay their bills or this or that or the other thing. Maybe it'll work out. I don't know. Leah Long joins us now, director of Louisiana chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, to talk about how they feel about small business, about proposed tariffs, and what they hope to see lawmakers tackle in the upcoming session. How you doing, Leah?
Hey, I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Tell me your thoughts about what are small business people thinking about tariffs?
You know, we have heard from a few small business owners that are currently impacted or they're concerned. But, you know, right now they're energized kind of on the new administration in general. They're energized on what it can look like for their future. But on a federal level, yeah, we have heard some kind of complain about tariffs, be a little uncertain about what it looks like. But right now their biggest issue is actually the 20% small business deduction. I think we've talked about that on here quite a bit. But that's their biggest concern right now, because if that's not reinstated, doesn't really matter what goes on with the tariffs, because they're going to be hit with a huge tax increase if it isn't reinstated permanently.
Let's talk about that. 20%, what is it you said?
It's a 20% small business deduction. So obviously right now, small businesses are not, they don't pay the taxes on the first 20% of their profit.
Okay, wait, hang on, Leah. Let me slow up a little bit here. You're talking about federal taxes?
Yeah, federal.
Okay, mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. So first 20% of profits is not taxed by the IRS as it stands now?
Yes. Okay. So it's called it was put back when the Trump administration was first in. It's the 20% small business deduction. It's actually set to expire in 2025.
Okay.
So, you know, there's a huge push between small business owners and FIB to get this reinstated. And so we're urging all of Congress, you know, the importance of this, and that if, you know, small businesses don't get this reinstated, they're going to be hit with a huge tax increase. And as we always say, it's already hard enough to own and operate a small business in the current economy, and has been for quite a while, that would be devastating for these small business owners.
Louisiana has a lot of stroke in Washington right now with Mike Johnson,
yes,
and Steve Scalise. I presume the small business Louisiana chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses has been in their ear, email, inbox, text, whatever you call it.
Yeah, constantly. And so far, the Louisiana delegation, they've been great. They understand. Some have been co-sponsors. So that's been a huge thing. But you've got to, you know, make sure you can see, make sure all Congress members understand, not just Louisiana. So as a group effort, hopefully getting that reinstated. And that kind of adds to a little bit of the uncertainty that they're concerned about with the tariffs. But, you know, you have that going on. Also, the tax thing. And, you know, just locally, I know we're going to talk about legislative priorities. Mm-hmm. And we always talk about insurance. So the small business owners, our main priority for this session is going to be insurance and lawsuit abuse reform. As we've talked about the last year, I guess, everyone's been talking about insurance. But we're hopeful that with Commissioner Tim Temple and the governor and the legislators that, you know, we can move in the right direction. It's not going to move overnight, but we need to start bringing bills that actually affect, you know, these insurance rates.
Tell me about the importance of small businesses, not just in Louisiana, but in the country. And I'll tell you in a second why I'm asking you that.
Well, you think about small business, it's pretty much the backbone of the economy. You know, it's what creates the community you live in. They employ the community, and they give back to the community. And you think about it, you go, you know, whatever town you may be in, there's a local store or something that is a small business owner. And those people set out to create a business and, you know, employ people and have a better life for themselves. And I always say that's the American dream, right?
Right. So the 20% small business deduction is important to the entire nation, not just Louisiana, and it's the National Federation of Independent Businesses. It would seem to me that this would be a slam dunk in Congress. Tell me what's the holdup? What's the problem?
It's just getting it reinstated. You know, every, you know, it takes, you know, you got to get it through there. You got to get it to the president's desk. So, you know, we're hoping, you know, administration obviously will sign it and that'll go. But you've got some people that, you know, whether what side of the aisle this is, this really isn't a this is a bipartisan issue, right? Because it affects every type of business owner. So it's not a political issue. It's, you know, it's a business issue.
So who's pushing back, Lee, I guess is what I'm wondering, because I don't care if it's a, you know, I'm trying to go as far left as I can. I don't care if it's a head shop that sells marijuana devices or it's a MAGA shop. Either way, it's a small business owner. So they're concerned about this. I don't understand who would be, why this would not breeze its way through Congress. Am I missing something?
Well, it was probably the previous administration, just some of the mandated overreach on small business. And so since it was not set to expire until 2025, no one, you know, in typical government fashion, they usually don't take care of it until, you know, right when you have to. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where they're at. If it would have expired, you know, in 2022, we probably would be here in the same position, regardless of what administration was in charge or not, trying to remind them the importance of this.
So if it does,
we're hopeful that it's going to get there.
If it does expire, what kind of effect does that have on small businesses?
Drastic. You know, you think about that, some 20% tax increase could do a business in. I mean, that's huge. So, you know, some of the small businesses that rely on that at the end of the year and make sure that that's calculated into their revenue and how they can reinvest in their company, and it'll affect, you know, how they pay their employees. So it's going to be devastating. 9 out of 10 small business owners will have major issues with this if it is not reinstated.
All right, let me take a break. 6:50, talking to Leah Long, Director of Louisiana Chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. We have already addressed tariffs and the 20% small business deduction. We'll talk about legislative priorities for that session that's set to begin later on this month. A cloudy, muggy Wednesday morning. Let's look at traffic now on WWL. 6:56, call it 4 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Leah Long, Director of Louisiana Chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. We've already talked about tariffs on this so-called Liberation Day and also about the 20% small business deduction. Leah, somebody texted in, and this is not a bad question, and they said, I own a small business, and I'm obviously all for it, but before Trump passed the 20% small business deduction, what were small businesses doing?
They still had the tax break. It just wasn't the full 20%. So there was a deduction in there, but it just got extended when Trump was in the first time.
Increased or extended?
Increased, not okay. Extended. We would love to extend. We need to extend and make it permanent forever.
All right, let's talk about, well, nobody wants to pay taxes. Let's talk about the legislative session. You talked about insurance and tort reform. Tell me the challenges that small businesses face as it relates to insurance. And are you talking about liability with slip and falls? Are you talking about vehicular insurance? All of the above?
All of the above. You know, that kind of breaks down into workers' comp issues and then, you know, the issues they face with that. But, you know, for small businesses, they rarely have the, you know, excessive amount of money laying around to fight these litigation costs. And so actually small businesses end up paying more in litigation costs because you've got to go get an attorney, do all of that. Most of these small business owners don't have an attorney in-house. They don't have one on, you know, retainer either. And so the high insurance rates and the legal expenses really do limit their ability to, you know, grow and create jobs and reinvest in their company. And so that's one thing that, you know, you think about a bad lawsuit, it could actually take a small business out, you know, if it's bad enough. And so I think that's one thing we've got to think about moving into the session is, you know, we've been talking about it for a year and a half now, but what do we do about the insurance rates? Well, they're getting unaffordable and, you know, it's just bad environment to own and operate a business if the legal climate is the way it is here.
Tell me about
so that's a big one.
With the small business break. Somebody texted in, what is defined as a small business, and by statute, who is it that gets the 20% break?
So the national, you know, federal is it's 500 employees or less, and then if you're not publicly traded, to make you an independent small business. So your accountant should know. You know, that's what I always say if people have questions. If you are a small business owner and you want to make sure that you're getting the full amounts that you need, you know, talk to your CPA.
So when it comes to insurance reform and tort reform, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And I've said this before, there's a way. But do you really think there's the will in a legislative session to do anything about this? Because the trial attorneys, and look, trial attorneys do some good work for some people. Trial attorneys are small business owners in a lot of different ways. But I don't see the political will changing anything soon. I might be wrong. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of spotlight on this session, you know, due to the constitutional amendments failing and, you know, kind of back to the drawing board on taxes. But we can't forget insurance. You know, none of us, as you said earlier, want to pay taxes, and we want to make it a better, you know, business climate here in general. And that also includes insurance. So I'm hopeful, because if we do nothing, then we'll get no changes. And so we can't keep doing nothing. We're about 20 years behind. States around us have big insurance packages. Florida, you know, they're trying to revamp their system. And so we've got to move forward. You know, we can't stay the same. If not, we're going to continue to get worse here in Louisiana.
I totally agree with everything you said, Leah, but my name's Thomas, and I'll believe it when I see it. Thank you, Leah Long, Director of the Louisiana Chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. We'll come back, talk to Jerry Bologna, Executive Director of JEDCO, about what could happen with the Esplanade Mall and some other things in Jefferson Parish. And we'll talk with Stephanie Regal, business writer for the Times-Picayune, NOLA.com, about the long-running bankruptcy case for the Archdiocese of New Orleans. Wednesday morning, moving right along. Stay with me, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Jerry Bologna joins us now, Executive Director of JEDCO, Jefferson Parish Economic Development Commission. How you doing, Jerry?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How are you doing this morning?
I am okay, sir, other than as I left work, I saw all these little oak fuzzy things flying in the breeze, and I'm thinking today's got Benadryl written all over it. Just
I can sympathize with that.
Let's talk about the Esplanade Mall, and then we'll work our way back to some things. What is going on with that mall? What did the kind of council look for? Tell me what the situation is.
Yeah, that certainly generated some attention last week. There are some challenges with the ownership of that mall, mainly being that they don't have clear ownership to the entire site. It's been, you know, well publicized that Dillard still owns their footprint. The Target owns their footprint within the mall property. There's a movie theater there, separate ownership. So it sort of carves out parts of the property, and it prohibits the owner, the main owner of the mall, from doing any sort of large scale redevelopment of the entire site. And what went before the council in the city of Kenner on Friday was they were seeking a resubdivision of another parcel to put a hotel on that site, and the Kenner council rejected that proposal with the thought that if we continue to carve it up, we're going to make it even harder for a large-scale redevelopment of that property, for one single owner to come in and do that lifestyle center, for example. And that's what certainly generated some attention.
I haven't been there, Jerry, in a long, long time, so you're going to have to walk me through this. So if you look at the area from above, if I were to look at a diagram of it, the walls are joined, the walls are common. But Dillard's is a separate piece of property from Target, which is a separate piece of property legally from the mall. Is that what we're saying?
That is correct. The current owner of the mall, they really own the interior portion of that mall. They do own the Macy's now. That's under common ownership. But the Dillard's is a separate parcel, a separate lot of record, separate parcel. The Target is the same. Movie theater, I believe, is the same. Mm-hmm. So if you want to do something expansive there, you're dealing with irregular lot lines and having to build, you know, you can't do a square building there or something of that fact.
That seems to me to be a level of complexity like I've never heard of before. Are there precedents for this either in the area or around the country?
Yeah. No, there are certainly precedents for it, but it creates challenges, and I think that's one of the reasons that I know Councilwoman Bohannon on the parish council, and I think the Kenner City Council, their interest is how do we get control of that site or get the current owner to get the entire control? Because once one developer has control of the entire site, then you can really get creative with the site. You can put it out for an RFP to bring in a developer and really tell them what you want to see, what the city wants to see there, whether it's hotels, lifestyle center, living units, retail, all of those things. But you have one person with control of the site that can dictate that instead of being constrained by these hurdles.
How many acres is that? Do you know, Jerry?
Ooh, offhand, I'm not really sure.
A bunch,
but
right?
It represents our largest East Bank redevelopment opportunity.
I guess what I'm wondering, would it be large enough if somebody were, and I don't know how Kenner would feel about this or how the Chateau residents would feel about this, if somebody wanted to buy Dillard's out, buy Target out, again, this is if we all had, yeah. If my aunt had, you know what, she'd be my uncle. But if somebody were willing to buy everybody out, could this potentially be a place for maybe some upscale housing or homes or something like that? Or have y'all talked about that? I'm just thinking about stuff here.
Yeah. No, I think everything is on the table. I think one consideration, though, that is important is all of South Louisiana is heavily reliant on sales tax. Mm-hmm. And so there is a keen interest in making sure that comes back commercially in some way, because the Esplanade at one time was the largest sales tax generator in Kenner, and they certainly would like to see it that way again, because that certainly helps with quality of life and services and things throughout the city, the more sales taxes that can be generated in the city.
So property taxes would not offset that? There would be a net loss?
It would not offset it totally, no.
Okay. So when it comes to the other mall in Jefferson Parish, Lakeside Mall, and the viability of that, here's what I'm trying to get to, Jerry, is that the Esplanade, back in the day, you know, just like I do, and yep, a lot of people do, malls were rocking, right? I mean, they even had the one on the West Bank, I forgot what that was, they called that one in Marrero, that they tore down completely. Bell Promenade, yeah, and now is a Lowe's or some Walmart, something else, whatever is on the site. Nationally, tell me about the future of malls, and here's what I'm getting to my roundabout way. Lakeside remains viable, but to think that Esplanade is going to come back as a mall, that's not really going to happen, is it? Or could it happen?
Yeah, no, I think that's unrealistic. And Tommy, I don't go nearly back as far as you do, but
remember sure.
some
absolutely
of those old
not.
Malls.
No, absolutely not. Certainly not.
I think
you would. By the way, Jerry's got his 24th birthday coming up. Jerry, congratulations. To achieve what you have achieved at 24 years of age, my friend, you deserve some type of award or something. But anyway, go ahead, please.
No, I think what you point out is fact. Lakeside Mall has been an extreme outlier in terms of mall development across the country. Malls were totally overbuilt throughout the country, and you saw them sort of wither and die, and you see some of these outliers like Lakeside, who now is probably the largest mall property between Houston and Atlanta, certainly the most upscale or having the ability to retain those upscale brands. And then the other properties are having to figure out how to redevelop. The malls that have survived usually have some sort of experiential aspect, whether it's a ice skating rink or a Dave and Buster's type development, something that's drawing people to that property. And then the others are having to reinvent themselves. Certainly at Clearview, for example, you've seen them bring in the Ochsner Super Clinic, multifamily residential. And now that that's done and they have the Target anchor, now they're moving on to the redevelopment of the interior part of that mall, but they have several anchors. Bell Promenade, that one took a long time to start the redevelopment as well, and it's still not where it needs to be. But they developed a lot of those out parcels with restaurants and retail, and now you're seeing them finally start to fill in the interior part of that mall property. But across the country, you're seeing malls redevelop as cultural centers, as lifestyle centers. where you have that live-work-play aspect.
Somebody texted something in, and I think it's a good idea. I'll explain when I return and reveal it to you and Jerry Bologna, Executive Director of JEDCO, Jefferson Parish Economic Development Commission, when we come back. What would you like to see done with that Esplanade Mall site? 722 Traffic Now, WWL. 727, Tommy Tucker, humid Wednesday morning, talking to Jerry Bologna, a youthful Jerry Bologna, 24 years old, and already the executive director of JEDCO, Jefferson Parish Economic Development Commission, which is amazing how you can have a child that's older than that, Jerry. But you know what? Look, let's not go into the physics of this and go into the time-space continuum. Let's just go with that, okay? No, but seriously, somebody texted in about an amusement park on that site because they thought that New Orleans East and the Jazzland and mess that all was failed because of the location, et cetera, et cetera. Would the site be big enough for something like that, or some kind of water park like they have in Baton Rouge where you go? Or I don't know what the trend is in the country with the viability of amusement parks or water parks. Anybody express any kind of interest in that or ideas about that?
There has been interest in that. There's been interest in sports facilities there, travel facilities, different types of sports facilities that are attractors of people to the region. So we are fielding prospects in pretty much every industry, and they have that site on their radar.
Would it be something that you would do, that you would go to a Six Flags, or I don't know who else is in the amusement park business, Dolly World, whatever, and say, hey, you know, we got this site in Kenner, be a good spot for you?
There are corporate relocation site selectors that specialize in that, those types of things, and we have conversations with those types of folks every day.
So,
yeah, I mean, that's how it happens.
So if you're talking about an IKEA, would that further complicate the situation or not?
I don't think that would complicate the situation.
The reason I asked that, Jerry, is that because then you're carving out a different parcel and something else that's there to prevent the whole thing from being redeveloped, right?
Well, to give you some perspective on that, the IKEA in their traditional format store, like you would see in a Houston or in Atlanta, they would need the entire mall site, inclusive of the Dillard's, Target.
Oh, really?
Everything. That's how big their stores are. So if you did something like an IKEA there, that would be the entirety of the site.
I've never been in IKEA. I get most of my furniture from, you know, inside of the road when people put it outside. It's good to know. Jerry, thank you.
You get it already assembled.
Exactly. Already assembled and broken in. Any final thoughts about what else is going on in Jefferson Parish?
No, we haven't lost any momentum. It was a strong start to the year. We're excited about initiatives all across the parish. We were supposed to be down in Grand Isle today, but the wind is prohibiting us from doing that. But we're going to be launching an incredible brand for our Grand Isle off-bottom oysters. But winds all across the parish, and I'm happy to come on again and soon and talk about those.
Talk to Jordan, please. We'd love to have you. One other question I want to ask you real quick. The travel ball facility, how's that proceeding on the West Bank?
It's looking great. If you haven't been out that way, that's towards almost the rear of the TPC golf course. And I believe that's going to be coming online soon. And we're excited about the future. I think that's another draw where people are going to be coming to Jefferson Parish from all over.
I have been there. It's awesome looking. And maybe people, when they go to the golf tournament, can take a ride out there and see it. Thank you, Jerry. Take it easy.
Have a good one.
Talk to you soon. Jerry Bologna, Executive Director of JEDCO, Jefferson Parish Economic Development Commission. We'll talk to Stephanie Regal, business writer for the Times-Picayune, NOLA.com, about the Archdiocese and their bankruptcy case and what's going on with that when we return. Right now, time for WWL First News. 7:44, 16 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly to Stephanie Regal, business writer for the Times-Picayune, NOLA.com. Very talented journalist, and I'm a big fan of hers. Good morning, Stephanie. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm okay. Let's talk about the Archdiocese and a bankruptcy case. Maybe you can give me a little bit of context on this with the 5-year anniversary of the bankruptcy approaching and how we got from there to here.
Right. So on May 1st, it'll be 5 years since Archbishop Amon placed the Archdiocese in bankruptcy as a way to deal with the growing number of what were then only about 36 or so lawsuits against mostly priests and some deacons and others for past child rape and molestation. You know, it was never a move to deal with an insolvent church. At the time, he even told the Vatican very clearly that the church was very solvent, but more as a way to deal with the potential for mass tort litigation and come up with a reorganization plan so that everybody could get something, so that they didn't have to deal with a race to the courthouse and also perhaps some of the ugly things that would have come out in tort trials. But anyway, it's been, as the judge said famously a couple of years ago, a knife fight since day one. And we're now approaching the fifth anniversary. And this week here in New Orleans, we're in the middle of 3 days of sort of high stakes mediation to try to work out a settlement. It's not at all the first time that the sides are talking, but it is the first in-person talks here in New Orleans at the law offices of Jones Walker, which represents the church. So they're trying to close a gap. Late last summer, I guess, the church filed a reorganization plan, an early draft, offering about $62 million, which is kind of lowball, but it should be said that that plan envisioned turning over the rights to the trustee, which is a technical thing, basically, but to allow the plaintiffs in the case, the abuse survivors, to go ahead and sue the insurers for additional compensation. So $62 million theoretically would not be the extent of it, but they would hopefully be able to collect from insurance companies additional monies. That's far, far short of what the survivors committee filed, their own plan seeking nearly $1 billion. However, their plan did include about $777 million from the insurance companies. The insurance companies have not agreed to pay anything close to that amount, and one of them, Sparta Insurance, is insolvent. So we don't know if we'll even get anything out of Sparta. So if you take the insurance money out of the survivors' plan, there's a $150 million gap they've been working to close. And there have been comments in court to suggest that they have made some progress trying to close that gap. But because the mediation is privileged, we don't know how far apart they are at this point. But that's one of the things they're trying to work out this week. And then next week, the insurers will be invited to the table, and they'll try to work out some of the more specifics with them in terms of how they go about collecting. But, you know, this might happen. It really might not. Mm-hmm. And it's just 5 years in, as we said, on May 1st, a very painful anniversary for the survivors, many of whom are older. A lot of this abuse happened decades ago, and some of them are dead. And it's just very, very frustrating for them and their attorneys. And it's been a huge problem and a black eye for our archdiocese, as it has four archdioceses around the country. But this one has just been among the longest and more costly cases. And so it's been a hard one.
Knife fight, right?
Knife fight, yes. Yeah.
So let me ask you this, Stephanie. As you said that, something just clicked in my mind. You said when he declared bankruptcy in 2000, there were how many claimants or how many abuse survivors?
Well, there had been, I can't remember exactly, but there had been about 36 lawsuits filed in state court at that time.
And since then, that number
It came after Archbishop Ama had published a credibly accused list of clergy. And at the time, the list wasn't even complete, and it has grown as they have added more names to it. But in the wake of that, you started to see these lawsuits, and I think the assumption was that more were coming. The bankruptcy process froze that. And now we've had hundreds of claimants file claims, basically, with the court, saying I too was, you know, abused.
So let me tell you what I heard. What I heard was that the Archbishop filed bankruptcy. At that time, he told the Vatican, the church, the archdiocese was not insolvent. And here's what clicked in my head, Stephanie, is he knew the extent of what was being covered up, what was being hidden, and he knew that there were going to be a lot more claimants. So he figured, to get ahead of it, now's the time to file bankruptcy. Would that be a false presumption on my part, or do we have any facts to back that up at all?
No, I don't think so. You know, but the interesting thing, I mean, just as a legal argument, in the churches across the country, this, I mean, he didn't come up with this plan, right? He was taking a page from a playbook that other dioceses around the country adopted almost two decades ago, going back to the early 2000s, when the extent of this clergy abuse crisis became public. And so, you know, the idea is to approach these kind of cases where you're going to have many, many claims, whether it's dozens or hundreds, as a mass tort, like the asbestos litigation or the Purdue Pharma opioid abuse litigation. And you basically put the institution in bankruptcy, and then you come up with a way to divide up however much money everybody agrees to so that everybody gets something, and that you don't have the first three guys who filed lawsuits have hellacious, you know, and very sensational trials with huge jury awards, and then the church really does have nothing left. I mean, there are people that say, yeah, but that's not what bankruptcy court should be for, and there are other people who say, and people apart from the church, I mean, I'm not at all trying to be an apologist for the Catholic Church, right, but it's a legitimate and very interesting legal debate that like, if you Googled it around, I could read about it all day. It's very, very interesting. I don't know.
Let me take a break, Stephanie.
The best way to do it.
And we'll pick it up when we come back. And I think one difference that we can address when we come back is if Gregory Amon was acting as the CEO of a subsidiary of a company, a la Entergy New Orleans, as opposed to the parent company to shield the assets, that's one thing. But when you're talking about the archbishop of a church who had their hands in a cover-up, a nasty, ugly cover-up, and exposing victims to predators without any knowledge or warning anybody, then you have to look at it, well, is that really the morally responsible thing to do? And is you, when you say the church, we got to distinguish that from the archdiocese, because Lord knows the Roman Catholic Church has assets. If you want to break it down to a sub-entity like the archdiocese, well, that's different. We'll talk more. We come back 752, 8 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 756, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Stephanie Regal, business writer for the Times-Picayune, NOLA.com, proud alum of Academy of the Sacred Heart, and also LSU, right?
And UNO.
Did some time at UNO. I was going to say that.
From UNO.
I was going to throw that in. You
don't
want to get to it. Absolutely.
Love them. Love them.
Me too. Do you teach at LSU, Stephanie, or not?
No, don't you think I should?
I
always wanted to pick up a class there.
I honestly think you should.
It never happened. Thank you. Well, maybe one day.
I am a big fan of yours. I mean that sincerely. Let's talk about, so what I mentioned before, if the archbishop, I don't know if you want to get involved here or not, because you're a reporter.
Right?
I don't want to go into opinion, but let me phrase the question this way. What the archbishop is doing for a Fortune 500 company would be what he should be doing to act in the best interest of the stockholders and the assets of the corporation. Would that be accurate or not?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, the issue is really, do you want to, and you know, reasonable minds may differ on this, but if you want to keep this archdiocese as a going concern so that it continue to do its mission, then you can't liquidate everything. If you believe that the wrongs that they admit they perpetrated and covered up are so grievous that all, you know, everything's on the table, then you liquidate everything and you give the survivors what they deserve, but then you don't have a church anymore. And I think that's probably the difference, you know, and I think there are those who believe that it should be shut down because you really probably, or, you know, I mean, that's one of the issues.
And to be clear, again, much like companies have different affiliates or different sub-entities to protect the assets of the major corporation, it is not the Catholic Church that is alleging bankruptcy or saying that they have no assets. It is the Archdiocese of New Orleans.
Correct.
And what happens from here? The lawyers continue to make out. I have a friend that's in estate law, and he says sometimes, and I'm not trying to make it about this at all, because the victims have a rightful claim, but he says, you know, y'all fight it out, and whatever's left you can have after you pay me. In a way, are the lawyers the big winners here so far?
The lawyers have made a fortune over this, and the lawyers on both sides, by the way. It's $44 million and counting. Every month, the monthly statements come out, and the numbers just keep going up and up and up.
So where do you think we are a week, 2 weeks from now, a month from now?
I could not say. I could see this thing, you know, come, because just remember this. Even if they do reach a settlement, there are still a lot of hurdles that we can talk about on a future show have to be overcome. And it may not get confirmed. It may not be approved.
Stephanie, let's plan on that. We're running out of time. And also want to have you back to talk about what happens if the case were to be dismissed. And Meredith Grable, the judge, has suggested that. So Stephanie Regal will come back and talk more about it on another day. Till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, a humid, windy Wednesday ahead, and this could be that way throughout the rest of the week through Saturday, maybe record heat, and then Sunday rain comes in ahead of a little cool front. This could be one of the last cool fronts we'll see, and the heat and humidity of summer are coming. Elections have consequences. There was one over the weekend, and voters rejected for the sixth time a tax proposition that would fund the parish's criminal justice system. Colin Sims joins us now, St. Tammany Parish District Attorney, who I presume has us on hold because I'm hearing some elevator music. Colin, you there? Colin's got us on. Tim, let's hear the elevator music again. All right, Colin's calling back. Apparently, we had a little bit of a technical issue there. I'll remind you, today is Wednesday at the Square. No rain. So you'll be able to go out and enjoy the best local music with WWL and Odyssey at the New Orleans Young Leadership Council's Wednesday at the Square concert series at Lafayette Square. CBD showcases all your favorite local music and emerging artists, food, arts, and crafts, like a little mini festival out there with the tents. Bring some money, enjoy yourself. It's free, open to the public, of course, if you want to eat something or drink something or buy something. You got to pay for it, but it's like a nice outdoor happy hour. It's festival time, time to unwind. And this afternoon at Wednesday at the Square, you can see Ashley O from our sister station, Bayou 95.7. She'll be out there today. It starts at 5, and she's going to introduce this week's band, People Museum with Kristen Diablo, and the city, presented by Abita Brewing Company, the YLC, and WWL. Now Colin Sims joins us, St. Tammany Parish District Attorney. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Morning, Tommy. How you doing?
I'm all right. Tell me, why do you think this failed on the ballot on Saturday?
I think it's a complicated set of things. I think this measure, coupled with other measures and amendments that, you know, different groups were for and against, you know, and I think we got caught up a little bit with some of that. But in addition, I think the taxpayers, parish government elected to rededicate and extend a 2% sales tax for roads, bridges, and drainage that was created in the mid-1980s. And it's been extended for 25-year periods since then, but it's only unincorporated St. Tammany's, what it was designed to pave the roads and do drainage for those areas back then. Only those areas got to vote on this measure. Well, if you're in St. Tammany and you have all this growth, the unincorporated areas of St. Tammany are the areas that have the most roads, bridges, and drainage problems. And so the people most affected by that particular thing that you try to expand the use of to be able to pay for your DA, your judges, the Justice Center, and the jail, are the people that are saying, wait a minute, we've got a need here for these things. Why are you selecting that and not something else to rededicate? I think that was a lot of it.
And I'm not asking you because I want your political analysis, Colin, as much as it seemed to me to make every bit of sense. And I don't know, it would have to have gotten caught up in something, at least from the way you explained it and everybody else explained it to me. It's not a new thing. It would just be, an extension. And as the, you know, you and I had this conversation that you can't put something on the ballot, or rarely do you see a tax that's put on in perpetuity. So occasionally they have to be renewed, and then people view that as a new tax, which it really isn't. So tell me what, you know what, Colin, we got a little problem here at the clock. Let me take a break. When we come back, you can tell me what happens from here, okay? And what it's likely to look like from here, or what do you guys do next, and what that money would have gone to, et cetera. Talking to Colin Sims, St. Tammany Parish District Attorney. A little technical glitch puts us behind the clock, but we'll catch up. 850, 10 till 9, traffic now, WWL. Eight fifty-five, five till nine. Tommy Tucker, WWL, Wednesday morning, April 2nd, talking to Colin Sims, St. Tammany Parish District Attorney, about the extension of a sales tax that was rejected by voters. Colin, again, just to recap, that money would have gone to, and will be, and it is still going to, because it doesn't expire until when? Let's clear that up too.
You got the rest of this year and then five more years.
All right.
So the roads, bridges, and drainage tax is in place at the same rate for the next 5 to 6 years.
And what was the money, if this had passed, what would have changed as far as, I guess, law enforcement and criminal justice in St. Tammany Parish?
So the tax rate would have stayed the exact same. It would not have increased, which means it would have been at the same rate since the mid-1980s. And then up to 17%. Would have been available, not that it had to, but it would have expanded the potential use of up to 17% of those funds for the criminal division of the DA's office, the Justice Center, and all of the judges, which would have freed up this general fund to pay the other legal mandates of the parish. Because, Tommy, you got $780 million dedicated. You got $16 million in a general fund. The DA's office, the jail, the judges, and the Justice Center cost more than $16 million to run. This was never about more money. This was about not having to cut those agencies. And I think it's between, and I say, and this is why it's a range, between $5 and $9 million deficient with the current level of funding in the general fund. It's the only fund that has flexibility to pay our bills, because we don't have any dedicated monies to pay us.
I think from the text I'm getting, it was, I think it all got caught up in the amendments and everything else. Or do you think people thought that this was going to take money away, to what you alluded to earlier, Colin, that this was going to take money away from other projects? Thoughts?
I think everyone's reason is different, and it's not uniform. I think a lot of the reasons are individualized to different citizens based upon where they live and the problems they're having. You know, a really good friend of mine sent me a text that I thought, he's very well educated, way up in medical sales, executive level. He says, Colin, I believe that public safety, I think that drainage is the bad seed riding on the coattails of public safety. It is a hot button topic around here. And the areas of public safety, which are your incorporated areas, Slidell, Mandeville, Covington, they don't even get to vote and weigh in, because you're talking about a sales tax district, the renewal of it and rededication for only the unincorporated areas of St. Tammany. And so you have a whole group that may say, yes, that makes perfect sense from a public safety standpoint, because we also prosecute the cases of the Slidell Police Department, the Mandeville Police Department, Madisonville, every municipality, but those people don't get to vote, even though they're very affected as to whether or not we're funded or not. And I think that is a something that's got to be fixed.
So what do you do now, Colin? How do you proceed from here?
I think that our office's job in this is to assist parish government to be ultra transparent of where every dime is going, engage the public, and begin to ask questions and say, look, guys, these are the needs. If you believe that, as an example, the DA's office receiving $6 million in funding from parish government, if you look at that and conclude it's reasonable, where do you want us to get it from, because this account doesn't have it in it? These are the available options to begin to rededicate. Are you okay with that? And get some buy-in, get some ownership. I think that would help.
When is the next election date
to save that money
in Louisiana? Do you know, Colin?
I don't.
We only have a minute left, and I didn't mean to catch you flat-footed there, but I can look it up. Sure. But at what point do the voters get, or do you get another chance to ask the voters to approve this?
I'll say it this way. We need to wait at least a year, figure out a way to survive, engage the public, take the time to educate them, not during just an election, and really have them understand the dedication problem and get some engagement to restructure.
Thank you, Colin. I appreciate your time. You have a good day. I think the next election is they have some municipal elections on May 3rd in the state and another one on June 7th. Taking a break. Coming back, WWL. Here we are, 9:09 on Wednesday morning, April 2nd. It is Liberation Day. We're all waiting to see what happens with the tariffs that President Trump has threatened and says he's going to impose. Maybe that'll cause you to have a drink or two to calm your nerves. Maybe what's going on with the economy. And alcohol, April is Alcohol Awareness Month. And every year, 178,000 Americans die from excessive alcohol use. So we're going to spend some time with Dr. Patricia Molina from LSU Health New Orleans, our friend, about how alcohol affects our bodies and our health. Dr. Molina is the director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Center of Excellence at LSU Health New Orleans. Good morning, Dr. Patricia. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
I'm okay. What do your friends call you? Not your friends, but your patients. Dr.
Molina.
Well, there you go. Well, I guess that's what I'll call you, Dr. Molina.
Yes, sir.
I was talking to my own physician the other day during an appointment and just mentioned that because of the medications, I guess, I take. I don't know what it is, but I can't have one drink. I can't have a beer, one cocktail without it just making me severely ill. And I told him that I missed drinking and I used to maybe drink too much, but I guess I said that for a backdrop of, is it necessarily bad to have a drink every day or occasionally, et cetera?
So occasionally is not bad. I would preface it by saying that every person is different from the person right next to you. So while maybe you will go through a lifetime consuming one drink maybe every other day or no more than 5 to 6 drinks a week and nothing really is going to happen to you, you might be one of those individuals that just consuming less drinks, less alcohol, you will have medical consequences. And so I think that it is difficult to make a blanket statement. It is recommended or it is considered that drinking in a pattern that is considered at risk is when you drink more than 3 or 4 drinks on any given day or more than 7 drinks a week for a woman or more than 14 drinks a week for men.
So say that again, doctor, please.
Okay, so I'm going to try to say it again slowly. So if a person drinks more than 3 or 4 drinks on any given day, so think Mardi Gras day, mm-hmm, that is considered at-risk drinking. In addition, if you want to think of it, you know, not only on Mardi Gras day, if you want to think about it throughout the year, mm-hmm, if a woman drinks more than 7 drinks a week, so think of it, that is one glass of wine with each meal. Mm-hmm. That is considered at-risk drinking.
Wow.
And for men, the number goes up and it is 14 drinks a week that is considered to be at-risk drinking.
That's a big difference.
So it is a huge difference, but there's many reasons for that big difference, beginning with the size of our bodies. In general, men are bigger than women. The amount of area or the amount of volume where the alcohol is going to be distributed in men is larger than women. But we also have differences in the way that we handle alcohol, in the way that we break it down, that we metabolize it.
Between men and women?
Yes.
Really?
Men have a better capacity of holding, you know, of metabolizing alcohol than women do.
Is that due to hormones, doctor? I'm just curious. I don't mean to get too far into the lab.
No, it's not necessarily due to hormones. This is due to the amount of the enzymes that are involved in breaking down alcohol mm-hmm. and how much of that enzyme is present in our digestive system, in our gut, in our liver. So women have less enzymes to break down alcohol than men.
So just as it's not fair, some people that can eat more than, well, no, I'm just saying some people can eat more than others and not gain weight. Bigger people can consume more food than smaller people and not gain weight. But it's the same thing with alcohol. Whether you like it or not, yeah. It's a biological fact, and it's just the way people are wired. Accurate?
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. That is a very good comparison.
Well, thank you, doctor. Let me ask you about at risk. When you say is considered at risk, what does that mean?
At risk means that it is a pattern of alcohol drinking that might have negative consequences. And you can think of it as immediate consequences. So if we get very, very drunk following three or four consecutive alcohol drinks, the consequences can range from passing out to having a motor vehicle accident to getting into an altercation with somebody else to drowning in a pool to driving and crashing. So those are risks that come with an acute alcohol intoxication. But if you think of it over your lifetime, if you continue to consume alcohol in an at-risk pattern, meaning every day you're down in two, three drinks throughout the week, you know, you stop distinguishing weekends from weekdays, then that pattern of alcohol use, which is also an at-risk pattern, but that is a chronic pattern of alcohol use, that can have consequences, including liver disease. So beginning with hepatitis, alcoholic hepatitis, followed by fatty liver, followed by fibrosis, and very, very high risk for liver cancer. It doesn't just affect the liver. It can affect your heart. You can have enlargement of your heart. You can have loss of cardiac function with chronic alcohol drinking. It can affect your gut. For example, it can change the flora in your intestines. It can also change the permeability, meaning how leaky your intestines are. And alcohol has been shown in many, many, many different studies to increase the leakiness of the gut. So think of all the stuff that we have in our guts that we want to keep it there. We don't want to have it come into our circulation. That is a risk that you run with alcohol use. And then the organ that we all recognize and everybody is very aware is impacted by chronic alcohol use is the brain. So depending on the age of consumption with early childhood use, which we know that does occur, mm-hmm. it can impair learning, it can impair memory, it can impair reflexes. And as we age, the pattern basically affects different functions in our body. So as we age, it can impair our ability to drive, our balance, increases the risk for falls, increases the risk for fractures. And I could go on and on and on because there is not a single organ in our body that is not impacted by at-risk alcohol drinking.
Let me ask you about the mind-altering effects of alcohol. What's going on in our brain? Because let's face it, it is a drug. People do drink, sometimes occasionally, I guess, for the taste of it, if you're going to sip some wine. And I'll say a couple of things, doctor, and then I'll shut up and let you talk. But it seems to me, and I jokingly call it mommy's calm-down juice, I think sometimes I think wine has kind of morphed into it's acceptable to have 3-4 glasses of wine a night because it's wine and it's not traditionally, you know, thought of as vodka or alcohol or anything else. But it is still the same thing and the effects are still the same. That's a jumbled mess I just gave you. But you're smart. You can sort that out, right? You understand where I'm going with that?
I think I know where you're going with this. So, and I think you have at least three questions built into that.
That'd be about right for me. That's the average.
So let's start by thinking of wine as a quote-unquote better alcohol. There's no such thing as a worse or a better alcohol. Alcohol is alcohol. What changes is the volume that you're drinking. So, for example, a glass of wine, 5 ounces of wine, is the same thing as if you were drinking 8 ounces of malt liquor, or if you were drinking 12 ounces of beer, or if you were drinking a shot of liquor, you know, whether it's vodka or tequila.
I knew you'd figure it out. I knew you knew what I was trying to get at. Okay, go ahead.
Alcohol is alcohol. Yeah. Alcohol is alcohol. There's no distinction. Now, when you say that it has that mommy calming effect, indeed, at low concentrations in our blood, when we start drinking, that first initial feeling of being relaxed, of being a little bit more, you know, willing to have a conversation, maybe more willing to get up and go dance with somebody, that slowly progresses to negative effects. And so what ends up happening is that as the alcohol use, as the alcohol drinking continues, there's a transformation of that individual. That individual is no longer your relaxed mom that had one glass of wine. That individual becomes the aggressive person at a bar. That individual becomes the person at home that will abuse the wife or the children. That person is the one that will now not have their common sense intact and get in a car and get out and have an accident. So there's almost, you could think of it, you know, as a slow wave that happens when we start drinking alcohol. And so the trick, to a certain extent, is knowing when to stop. And it's easier said than done, because it's, you know, 9:20 in the morning, and right now my senses are completely, you know, in tuned. But the minute that I start drinking, I'm going to start losing my ability of making those decisions. And so knowing, or having a partner that will tell you this is enough, or just, you know, programming yourself to say, I'm not going to have more than one glass of wine, or I'm going to space my drinking with water, for example, or I am not going to drink on an empty stomach. Those are things, those are decisions that we can make before we even start drinking that can protect us from falling into that, you know, range of alcohol that makes us completely lose our ability to function appropriately.
When it comes to, and the text line is just going crazy here, with people asking about what makes people some happy drunks, some mean drunks, what happens in, I will ask you, first of all, what are the statistics show on that, about happy or mean? Why are you predisposed one way or the other, if you are? And what happens in the brain to cause all of that? Again, about five questions, Doc, so jump
in. And the last one is a little bit more complex.
Okay.
But let me start by saying, different, like I said at the beginning, different people have different consequences from alcohol drinking. You can say the same thing about the immediate or acute responses to alcohol. I might have a glass of wine and it might be the most relaxing event of the day. Others might have a glass of wine and may react negatively, may get a headache, may feel disgust, may not even enjoy it. There are changes or there are differences in how our brain responds to alcohol. But in general, in the beginning phases when alcohol starts creeping up into our blood and bathes our brain, there are neurotransmitters. These are chemicals that are being released by cells in our brain that change in the rate that they're being liberated, in the rate that they're being released. And so that is what explains the changes in the behavior. In some people, that soothing or relaxing effect can very, very quickly transform or morph into a very aggressive behavior. But it really isn't just due to differences in individuals. It really does link back to how much alcohol you're drinking. So, said in a different way, one glass of wine is not going to get that person to that aggressive stage. one glass of wine is not going to get that person to start doing risky, you know, things like getting in a car or getting in a boat and or jumping in a pool and drowning. It's really very, very linked to how high your blood alcohol concentrations are in your system. And so as we start drinking, the relaxed state, you know, maybe if you're asking me to give you an idea of an investment, I may not be able to give you a sharp idea, but I'm still pretty coherent. Mm-hmm. That is at very low concentrations, like a 5% blood alcohol concentration. If you think of it, as levels start creeping up, we start losing our ability to have good reflexes. Mm-hmm. We can't, you know, stop the car if somebody crosses our path. And that has been what, after many, many, many studies, the legal level for driving, you know, is 80 milligrams per deciliter, or 0.08 percentage. And that is not, you know, that is not a random number. That is not a number that, you know, the highway police came up with overnight. That has been demonstrated by many, many studies. There are studies that are very sophisticated that get people to kind of pretend they're driving while drinking alcohol so that the scientists can actually tell at what point they lose their ability of controlling their reflexes.
Let me take a break, Doc. We'll pick it up here. We come back. Alcohol Awareness Month, that's what April is. That's what we're in. Over 178,000 Americans die each year from excessive alcohol use. And some pretty amazing numbers that Dr. Molina told us. Dr. Patricia Molina, director of the Alcohol Drug Abuse Center of Excellence at LSU Health New Orleans. Alcohol is alcohol, a 5-ounce glass of wine, same as an 8-ounce malt liquor, 12-ounce beer, or one shot of tequila or hard liquor. And if you drink more than 3 or 4 on any given day, you are considered an at-risk drinker. Talk and text line open, 504-260-1870. If you have any questions or comments, we'll be back in a flash. Tommy Tucker, WWL. It is 9:30. I have an interesting conversation with our friend Dr. Patricia Molina, director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Center of Excellence at LSU Health New Orleans. April is Alcohol Awareness Month. And Doctor, I got to tell you, I think, and I'm getting some text here complimenting you on what a great job you're doing. You're a very smart doctor, and you're sharing the information with us that alcohol is alcohol. And you can maybe, let me phrase it this way. A glass of wine might be more socially acceptable than a glass of cheap vodka out of a dirty glass. But as far as your body is concerned, when it comes to the amounts or proportions, it's the same thing, right?
Absolutely correct. The body cannot tell the difference.
So for people that, I guess, how would people recognize, for example, and I look, I'm just going from experiences and from anecdotal evidence and things that I've seen, but how would a woman go about determining, or a man, if, you know, they got kids or whatever, and maybe, you know, they have a bottle of wine a night or along those lines? That would seem like a lot for two people, would it not? A bottle of wine every night?
Yes, a bottle of wine every night for two people is definitely excessive, and it is definitely, it falls into the category of at-risk drinking or heavy drinking.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, again, I think, and would you agree that sometimes it gets a pass because it's wine as opposed to a shot of bourbon or tequila, as you said?
Yes, I think that, you know, and you mentioned correctly that it's much, you know, it's nicer to see somebody holding a glass of wine. I mean, it's more sophisticated if you wish, and it's more socially acceptable, but it's the same, you know. Once it gets into your body, once it gets into your system, alcohol is alcohol.
And it is a drug. It is a mind-altering substance. Let's just be honest and upfront about that. Accurate?
Accurate. It is the most frequently consumed legal drug of abuse.
So we as a society have determined that that's legal. We tried to make it illegal, and I'm not trying to bring you into the realm of politics or law here because you're a scientist, but we have determined as a society that it is legal. and we tax it and license it and so forth and control the way it's distributed. But when it comes to the harmful effects on society, is there a marked difference between alcohol or, say, other substances or other drugs? I guess there are some drugs that are far more dangerous than alcohol, but are they in the same neighborhood?
So I think that this is a very important concept, and I'm going to try my best to use this question to send a message that perhaps is not as frequently appreciated, which is everybody worries about cocaine and amphetamines and fentanyl. It's very sensational, you know, and those are drugs with very, very high risk of lethal consequences. And so, in general, people tend to think that alcohol is not that bad, right? Because few people associate this person went out drinking and died because of drinking on that given day. People try to look or ignore how frequently, particularly among young individuals, and we've seen several cases in our campuses in the state, alcohol intoxication can be deadly. But in addition to being deadly, when consumed in a short period of time, when reaching very high blood alcohol levels, the chronic use, which is actually what ends up, you know, creating a burden on the body, that chronic consumption of alcohol throughout the lifetime is what ends up hitting all the different organs in our body and producing changes that are chronic changes. I'll give you additional examples. I talked about the liver. I talked about the gut. I told you about the heart. I told you about the brain. For example, alcohol use has been linked with osteoporosis, so loss of bone mass. Alcohol use is a frequent cause of sarcopenia, and sarcopenia means a loss in muscle mass. So when you see those individuals with very, very skinny legs, you know, with very stripy muscles, that loss in muscle mass is due to the chronic use of alcohol. Alcohol use has been linked with problems at the level of the endocrine system, so regulating your blood glucose. So if you're a diabetic individual and you're drinking alcohol, the ability of your pancreas to regulate your blood sugar levels is impaired. So to me, that is what sets alcohol apart from all the other mostly illegal drugs. I mean, the only other legal drug that I can think of right now is cannabis, marijuana. But the price that the body pays for chronic alcohol use does not compare to any other drug of abuse. It is much higher. And because it's socially acceptable, because, you know, it's a good thing that you went to your doctor and you opened up and said, you know, I don't feel well when I have a drink. Studies have shown that less than half of doctors actually ask their patients about their drinking patterns, which is a huge missed opportunity, because if you find out that your patient does have a problem with drinking, then you can open the conversation about possible ways of helping that individual drink less or quit completely, depending on the health status of that person. And not everybody has to completely go dry, but just cutting the amount of alcohol that the person is consuming is a step in the right direction.
I used to drink a lot, to be clear. I don't think I've had any more than one drink in any given day in 10 years. And because when I do have a drink, it just makes me feel terrible. I don't know if it's the medication I'm taking. I'm not asking you to Dr. Molina to diagnose me over the phone, but is there something, and once you get away from it, where maybe your body doesn't tolerate it anymore or something? Or what?
So what you're describing is what we in the scientific community know as the sick quitter syndrome.
Okay.
So your body, over the years, got to a point where it just does not react well to alcohol. And so that is what has forced you to quit. So it's that sick quitter syndrome. So if we were to do a survey right now or a poll and ask people, do you drink? A lot of people will say, no, I don't drink. But they don't tell you that all their lifetime they were drinking 3-4 drinks a day.
Yep.
or that they would, you know, spend all weekend partying throughout the lifetime. And so now they're telling me, no, I don't drink. Well, you know, all the damage that, that alcohol over the years did to your body does not turn around overnight. There are many of the changes that can reverse, that can improve, but many of them cannot. The changes at the level of the liver, there's no going back. The changes at the level of the heart, there's no going back. The changes in the level of muscle are very, very hard to recover. The changes in bone are quasi impossible to recover. So there is a consequence of this lifelong alcohol drinking in an at-risk pattern.
I'm amazed at you saying that, because, you know, we all tend to think we're in a silo, we're the only person that goes through anything, but sick quitter syndrome, that describes it. Doctor, real quick before we let you go, and I could talk to you 8 hours about this, because I think it is important, and because it is a drug, it does cause a lot of problems in society, but we have deemed that it's going to be legal, and we tried to make it illegal, and we know what happened. Tell me about addiction. Are some people more prone to addiction to alcohol? Is it different than other drugs? Or if you have an addictive type personality, does it matter whether it's alcohol or opioids or what have you?
So, yes, there are differences in how easily a person becomes addicted to a drug. Yes, there is overlap between addiction to alcohol, to other drugs, to sex, to video games. So addictive behaviors do share a lot of the different characteristics. And if you were to ask me, what is the number one thing that increases your risk for addiction to alcohol, is if you have a family history that your parents, one of your parents, or somebody in your ancestry had an alcohol use disorder problem, which is now the term. Now we're moving away from using the term alcoholic, because that is considered to be like a negative connotation towards the person. So now we're fixing on using alcohol use disorder. So if you are the child of a parent that had an alcohol use disorder, you are at a much higher risk of becoming addicted to alcohol. And in addition, if you start drinking at an early age, and when I say early age is in your teens, that also increases your risk for becoming addicted to alcohol.
Doc, I don't know if somebody gave you my personal file or not, but you're pretty well nailing a lot of it. I appreciate your time and your expertise. I really do. I hope you come back and talk to us some more about this, because I think it is very important in terms of society and damage that it does, and you know that perhaps better than I do. Dr. Patricia Molina, Director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Center of Excellence at LSU Health New Orleans. Doctor, real quick, resources for people that think they may have a problem with drinking or curbing their actions, what would you suggest?
I can give you the website for the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Addiction, NIAAA, and you can go on that website, and they have resources that are for the lay community. They also have links that will allow you to find places where you can receive help and treatment.
The website is what, Doc?
Let me give it to you.
You know what? Tell you what. We're going to take a break. Tim will get it, and I'll give it out on the air when we come back, okay?
Perfect.
Thank you, Dr. Molina. Pleasure as always. 9:41. We'll talk Pelicans basketball when we come back. Time now for traffic on WWL. The website to find out more about the effects of alcohol from Dr. Molina that she was going to recommend is niaaa.nih.gov/alcohol/effects/health. I would start with niaaa.nih.gov, and I think you'll be directed from there. Ollie Cosell joins us now. Boy, I'm going to tell you what, the Pelicans, and I don't mean to make light of what we're just talking about, but the Pelicans can drive you to drink sometimes. And I do honestly miss drinking. I miss it, and I think it's probably having the, what did she called it, the quitter? Sick quitter syndrome is probably God's way of telling me that me and booze don't get along. Anyway, Ollie Cosell, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing well.
the season, if it wasn't over, it is over. Tell me what's going on with C.J. McCollum and Zion.
Yeah, the Pelicans have decided to shut them down for the rest of the year. Not a surprise, several reasons. Both were dealing with minor injuries. And the fact that you want to, in a season that was completely lost almost from the start, you want to end up with a good draft pick. So they want to kind of maintain the position where they are at, you know, currently the fourth worst record, and there's a couple teams right behind them. So you don't want to win any kind of meaningless games down the stretch while pushing several injured players, right, into playing games and maybe even further injuring themselves. Because, look, the Pelicans lost three players, significant players, for the rest of the season. That's probably going to affect them for next season. So you don't, like I said, you don't want to take any chances. No reason to.
You're walking a fine line between tanking it there, young man.
Yeah. Look, I'll say one thing about the Pelicans. They have not been one of these teams that have been blatant about it, right? Utah Jazz all season have been sitting healthy players. Mm-hmm. Other teams like the Philadelphia 76ers to, you know, we just saw the Charlotte Hornets. There's certain teams that have either not played available players or sat good players down the stretch of games. We saw Charlotte do that with Miles Bridges the other day. Toronto Raptors have been doing it. The Pelicans have done none of that, right? So if you want to put some kind of silver lining here, you can't say the Pelicans are a tanker when there's been other teams that have been, like I said, doing that a lot more often this year.
So Zion played 30 games this year, 4 out of 6 seasons, 30 games or less. I go back to the old saying that our boss, Diane Newman, taught me a long time ago. I think it's from Maya Angelou. When somebody tells you who they are, believe them. I think we all know who Zion is now. Is that going to change?
Well, yeah, you know, there's two sides of this coin, believe it or not. Yeah, on the one side, yeah, history, obviously not on his side, playing in well than less than half of his games that have, you know, he's been available for, he's been in the league to play in. The thing, though, is this year we finally saw him kind of reach a certain different level of conditioning, right, especially coming off of that hamstring strain. We've never seen him lighter, more agile, more able to do things on both ends of the court, and the numbers show it. More impactful in the minutes he played than he has ever been in his career. So if he can build off of this, right, that's the key, right? Can he build off this, carry any of this over for the rest of in the next season, for the rest of his career? That's, of course, the biggest question mark. But I think there's a chance, right? I mean, there has to be some kind of turning point with every player in the league. And for Zion, if you want any kind of greatness, you've got to do that, right? So you've got to keep your weight under control. You got to be available. That's the number one key. And from everything he's done, I mean, I've talked to people. He's taken conditioning more seriously than he ever has in his life, being more of a team leader. You saw it, like I said, down the stretch of when he was playing. So, knock on wood, hopefully it carries over.
I'm going to be optimistic here, okay? Pelicans fan, love watching him play. We have to be, right. So, what can the Pelicans do from this point forward to put themselves in the best possible position for next year?
They've already done a few things, right? You needed to build your depth back again. Because last summer, we saw Jonas Valanciunas, Larry Nance, Dyson Daniels, Najee Marshall, all leave. And you didn't really replace them on the roster. So depth was immediately noticeable when first game of the season, you started losing players. There was nobody there to be able to hold up in those minutes, keep the team afloat. So I think they have found certain players, Brandon Boston this year. Now they're looking at Antonio Reeves, Carlo Matkovic, and a guy that I think is honestly going to be a good rotation player for them next season, Keon Brooks. So you're building the depth up by experimenting with these players that you've got on the end of your roster, see who can carry over to next year. And, of course, like I said, you want to have everybody healthy at the start of next season, and you want to end up with a good, best possible draft pick. So that's either going to be you can draft somebody that's going to step right in and help, or you can use that as a trade chip this summer to shore up whatever weaknesses, whether they want to add more help to point guard, because we all believe DeJounte Murray won't be ready to start next season, or shore up the center position, right? Eve Missy looks like he's got a promising career ahead, but let's face it, the rookie wasn't ready for the rigors or of helping his team win this year.
But he did show a lot of promise. That was a bright spot.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Look, Tommy, I don't have to tell you this, but the Pelicans have been dying to get a center that can defend the rim, fly around, right, be somebody that, you know, I think that they had hopes for, say, Jackson Hayes, but he never, of course, you know, turned that corner, grew, matured. But you want to have one of these mobile centers, right? You look around the league, typically that's what wins games, and you got to think back to Tyson Chandler was the last time the Pelicans, I felt like, really had one of those centers. So Eve Missy, yeah, he shows a lot of promise.
Any changes in the front office? Willie Green coaches the team next year?
I honestly don't think so. You know, when
the wait. I asked you two questions. You don't think there are changes, or you don't think he coaches the team?
I don't think they'll make any changes. Okay. Yeah, talking to people of late, David Griffin, last time we talked to him about 6 weeks ago, he gave him a vote of confidence. And when you just talk to people, like I said, he hasn't lost the team. You call these check boxes or these boxes, right, to see does he deserve to come back. And it just seems like I said, talking to people, he hasn't done so much as anything wrong as just the team failed him around him this year. He just didn't have the pieces. So if you haven't lost the locker room, you still got the vote of your players, chances are he'll probably be back.
Thank you, Ollie. I appreciate your time as always, and we'll look for next season. That's all we can do now. Ollie Cosell, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans, and you got to be positive. You got to help. You got to hope for the best. Thank you, sir. We'll take a break, find out what Newell Norman's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.